We're all here.
We're ready to go on the actual public record now. I'm going to open our House Committee on Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Rural Communities. Today is February 17th, 2009. Today we're going to have an informational meeting talking about a listing. Well, it's a potential listing or an actual listing, but we're going to find out more about it anyway here in a moment, of the sage grouse, what the ramifications are for Oregon. We've got a bill that I think we're going to be able to move. We'll find out. I don't see any letters of opposition here, but we'll find out when we get going if there's any issues with it. And then we have an informational meeting following that with a group that I learned about their existence in Ways and Means at one point as people were discussing it. Got very intrigued about what they can do for us here at the legislature and for the state of Oregon, and then had the opportunity to bring them in today to talk about what they do and what kind of things they work on. And that's the Oregon Independent Multidisciplinary Science Team. So, I have two items of business. There's a couple things in here that need to be entered into the record. One is a piece of testimony in opposition to House Bill 2210, which dealt with the Board of Ag membership that we changed. Unfortunately, it came in too late to get into the files, and the person was unable to be here, apparently. So it's already on the floor. You can consider this, I guess, for your floor vote, but it's obviously not going to make it in time for us to consider in committee, but I'll place it in the record anyway.
Do we have, we all have copies of that yet?
I think so. It's noted, yeah, the Friends of Family Farmers.
Okay.
Then item... the second one is House Bill 2216. This is the bill that has to do with forestry having authority to do bonding to purchase lands, and it's a letter from Richard Whitman, the director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Okay, are those in the record? Just as an informational note, my plan on that bill is to hold it until we figure out sort of a larger solution to this committee, at least, opinion on how we frame the purpose of the state forest. So essentially, what I'm trying to say is once we figure out the language we're going to be able to feel comfortable about on the Tillamook, I think we're likely to then be able to apply it to any other purchases. For example, if we move timber production up in the hierarchy or do something like that. So I think we ought to just continue to have that conversation in the context of the Tillamook issue as well. That'll make it easier to move 2216 if we want to, because I think members will feel either more comfortable or less comfortable with what the purpose of state forests really are by the time we're done with that. So I'm still waiting for that other bill, the Tillamook bill, to arrive, but that's my reason for not moving at this point. Doesn't mean we can't engage in side conversations, you know, with the forester about what's going on over at the Board of Forestry and all that kind of stuff, but it's the same debate. We might as well have it first and then see if we can apply the solution to both. Okay.
Is that the group?
Any other information people need before we get started? Great. So let's have... so who's coming up? Ron? Oh, and Kurt. From the department, going to come up and talk to us about the sage grouse listening.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Clem, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. With me today is Ron Anglin, our Wildlife Division Administrator. We appreciate the committee's interest in hearing about sage grouse and what's going on in Oregon. We have a lot of very good cooperative programs with landowners across eastern Oregon, and on staff have one of our one of the West's preeminent sage grouse biologists. I would like to have Ron Anglin go ahead and deliver today's testimony, as he is the expert in the field, so to speak. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Klimmer and members of the committee. For the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. Sage grouse are one of the probably the birds that we've been surveying the longest within the state. They typically, our surveys are conducted on spring breeding areas that are called lek sites, L-E-K, lek sites. It's where males do their strutting, and it makes it very easy. There are historical sites that the birds go back to. So we have surveys that actually go back into the 40s where we've been counting birds in primarily southeastern Oregon. And sage grouse are like most upland game birds. They do go in cycles where they'll have population peaks and declines. So they go through some natural cycles. A lot of that's associated with weather conditions. But we've also found through time that we're seeing an overall decline of sage grouse, not only in Oregon, but throughout the West. In Oregon, currently, we estimate the spring breeding population at about 25,000 birds. In a normal year, we would estimate the fall population with the juveniles to be around 35,000 birds. They have a fairly high annual mortality rate on the young, both primarily from natural causes. And they're of the game birds, they're a fairly long-lived bird that'll live maybe 4 to 6 years in the wild. Most upland game birds will only live about 2 years before they die. So they're fairly long-lived, which means that you can see some pretty immediate impacts when you lose adults in the overall population and the breeding capability of the population to respond to any kind of a climatic event or any other kind of a problem. As I said, we've been doing surveys since back in the 40s. Most of those surveys have been done on the ground. And starting in the late or the early 90s, we actually, in cooperation with the BLM, started doing some additional surveys. And we did those from the air in helicopters. They're part of a west-wide effort to start documenting sage grouse lek sites and population numbers. We increased our sampling of lek sites so that we could make a better determination of what the spring breeding population was, and have done that in conjunction with the other western states. And as a result of that, we've really tightened up the science on sage grouse and what those estimates are, and been able to start better depicting and identifying some of the trends in the population and overall what's happening. We do allow limited hunting on sage grouse. We're at the top of page 2. It's generally been found within research that you can take about 10% of the population. Our hunting seasons are designed to take less than 5% of the population. On most years, we take somewhere between 3 and 5%. And one of the main things we get out of that is we collect wings off of the sage grouse that are harvested, which gives us some age and sex data of the harvest, and then we can take that back and compare that to our spring lek counts and to our brood counts that we do in the summer, where we count chicks per adult, and we can make some estimates on chick survival over the course of the summer, and then make estimates on the overall population. This has proved to be very, very, very good data, and has really helped us out a lot in being able to defend the status of sage grouse within the state and what the populations are like. Through time, there's been, like I said, lots of different pressures on sage grouse, and there's been several attempts to have sage grouse listed over the years by some different groups. Up to this point in time, all of those attempts have been turned away by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. They've determined that the listing was not warranted. However, based on a lot of those concerns coming out of the 90s, the western states in particular banded together and started some major sage grouse initiatives, and Oregon participated in that as one of the key players. Out of that evolved our sage grouse conservation plan, which was adopted by our commission in 2005. It's a fairly comprehensive document that lays out strategies for conserving sage grouse populations and habitats, and really sets a kind of the guidelines for what we can do within the state to ensure we maintain healthy populations. Most of the western states undertook similar planning efforts at the same time and have instituted those. However, what we have found is that there's still interest within some groups for listing. In 2004 or 5, they pressed the service again for a listing, and the service in 2005 again issued a not warranted determination. However, in 2007, a judge remanded that back to the Fish and Wildlife Service and requested that they review their decision and make a new determination. The department took a very heavy role in supplying data to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for their review that they're conducting right at this point in time. We did that both as the state of Oregon and also through the Western Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies. Some of the other western states have seen some fairly significant declines in their population over time, and a lot of that has occurred through a direct loss of habitat in the sagebrush country. And it's possible that there are some subpopulations of sage grouse that the service could actually determine are warranted for listing. However, the request that was made was for the whole greater sage-grouse population, did not break it out in any kind of subunits or subpopulations, and at this point in time, we don't know for sure what the service will do. We feel that there's enough data there. We feel that there's enough information there that a listing is not warranted. However, they're looking at it from some different angles and some different viewpoints than what we necessarily have, and we've provided them collectively as the states with the best information possible. If they do decide to list, then they have several different choices that they can make. They can do a threatened or endangered listing for the whole range-wide portion of the population. They could break it up into distinct population units like the Gunnison sage grouse in Colorado. They've got four or five different management zones in effect that they've broken up as population units. So they could decide that it's warranted in some areas and not in others. Or they could decide that the listing's not warranted again. Obviously, if they're listed, they're listed in Oregon, that brings a whole different set of federal rules and regulations into play that would impact Oregon and how we're able to manage the birds, and also how landowners, both private and public, are able to manage the land. So it would have impacts if a listing were to occur on grazing industry, potential energy development in the southeast, and other types of entities that make a living on those natural resource areas out in southeastern Oregon. We're fairly hopeful that they won't make a decision to list in Oregon, but we won't know until sometime this summer. Under our management plan, we really have been fortunate. As Kurt said, we've got one of the premier grouse biologists in the West in Christian Hagen. He's located in our Bend office. He has five different local work groups that he is working with that have invested at this point in time over $3 million on the ground projects on primarily private land but some public land in southeastern Oregon, all with the effort of restoring sage grouse populations and habitats and ensuring that we can try and keep those populations healthy. A lot of the work has involved juniper removal. We found that as you get juniper coming into new areas where they haven't been for a very long time because of fire suppression, that you end up with predators coming in, primarily avian predators like ravens and accipiters, and then they will predate the nests and either take eggs or take the juveniles. So if you can remove those tall structures and those roosting sites and for those avian predators, then you can protect the lek sites. Around the lek sites, we look at about 80% of the birds, the hens that use the lek sites will nest within a 3-mile area of that lek site. So the birds are selecting what's the best place for the breeding displays, and then what's the best place for the actual nesting to occur. And then, so within that 3-mile radius, about 80% of the females that visit the LEC site, that's where they'll nest. And then they'll have their early broods come off there, and then depending on where they are, they may move up in elevation if they're in the right place, like the Steens or the Pueblos or the Trout Creeks. They'll move to higher elevations and do their late brood rearing in the late summer up at very high elevations where there's a lot of insects and a lot of moisture, and then move back down onto more protected winter ranges, heavy or tall sagebrush, things like that. So habitat's very key and very critical to these birds. Disruption of habitats, whether it's from fire, whether it's mechanical means, things like that, can have a very direct impact, especially around those LEC site areas, on overall survival of the populations associated with each of those LEC sites. With that, I'd like to conclude our prepared testimony and just open it up for questions.
Questions for these gentlemen? Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Chair. Do we have any estimates of what the optimal population was pre, you know, when we our settlers came here, as opposed to where we are now? Is there a number we're looking at trying to get back to?
Chair Clem, Representative Roblin, we really don't know how many birds were present back in the 1800s, for example. We do know that there used to be sage grouse in the Columbia Basin. They don't exist there any longer. We do know that there used to be more sage grouse in Baker County. They're very reduced numbers. We used to have sage grouse in the eastern portions of Klamath County, and they don't exist any longer. So we do know that we've lost probably what are the fringes of the population. We've got the core areas in southeast Oregon. Based on our LEC counts going back into the 40s, the data that we've got today, you know, the most that we have ever really estimated is about 40,000 adults in the state, and that seems to have occurred sometime in the last 10 to 20 years. But we've seen an overall decline in adults through time going back into the 40s.
Follow up on that.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you. The LEC sites, are we looking also on the federal properties for our studies, as opposed to just on our public lands and private lands? And if we are, you already gave an example. Part of the Klamath area is probably under federal sites. So those are naturally declining populations. I mean, it's not from hunting and those things. Or
Chair Clem, Representative Roblin, we look across all land ownerships. If we have permission to go on private land, we obviously would go there, but only with permission. Most of the LEC sites that we've documented are on public land because most of southeast Oregon is on public land. We've had very good cooperation with private landowners in the southeast. We've worked very closely with Oregon Cattlemen's Association. They have one of their prominent members, John O'Keefe, out of Lakeview, has been on the Cattlemen's National Sage Grouse Committee. We've worked very closely with John, and it's really been a beneficial partnership. So we're counting across all areas. The Klamath stuff, based on my experience when I was down there, I think that a lot of the declines that have happened there have been primarily because of juniper coming back in and overcrowding the LEC sites, and they're not secure LEC sites anymore, and opens that up to that avian predation.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. I had the benefit of having a long, nice conversation with Mr. England before the hearing, and I'm sure he just thought it was a wonderful conversation, too. Hey, I appreciate what you're doing here, and I appreciate the idea of getting out in front of something before, you know, some unintended consequence happens. You know, in our conversation, you talked about the possibility of decline in population being a tribute of the sage grouse, which, by the way, I want sage grouse, a sustainable, viable population of sage grouse there. You attributed it possibly to the decline in spring rains due to potentially climate change, which I think that you probably scientifically prove that's happening. And how do we get out and stop and slow climate change? Well, we do it by generating and transmitting carbon-free energy. Yet, oddly enough, here we are in a situation where there's a lot of areas down there where we could take advantage of wind energy, and the transmission lines and the generating sites would be right overlaid right over the top of these LEC sites. So we're damned if we're doing, we're damned if we don't, essentially. So I really, somehow, we need to figure out how both can go coexist. And I rather than a slow, drawn-out conversation, engaging process, I urge expediency on this. I want to get going on this. I don't want to wait, and I don't want a 10-year process. That's what I want. I just think we can't have our cake and eat it too, is what I'm trying to say. Something has to give, and I think you smart guys can figure out how we can build these things and maintain them without making the sage grass go in onto some listing. That's just what I wanted to say, and I don't think I'm being unreasonable in making those requests. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your indulgence.
Representative Frazier.
Well, I read something, and I can't recall where it was, the relationship between sage grouse and buffalo and cattle. It had to do with the food source as a result of the dung. It was pretty interesting. Have you ever read that?
Chair Clem, Representative Krieger, no, we haven't. I'll have to look for it.
My guess is that
probably there's some insects associated with with the buffalo droppings and cattle droppings, and that the birds are probably at certain times of the year actively looking for some of the insects maybe associated with that. The young birds are very dependent on a high energy diet that usually comes out of insects and green forbs in the early summer into the midsummer time period, and that's why moisture is pretty critical at that time frame, that you get the good green up, you get a good insect population. And I don't know if you've spent time out in the desert country, but a lot of those lake beds, playas that you see out there, that typically, you know, they're very wet early in the spring, early summer, and then they start to dry up and evaporate over the course of the summer. But what you get with those is a constant wet edge, and you get a constant different set of forbs coming out over a long period of time and insects associated with that. And those are very critical sites to sage grouse. And, you know, it's kind of a natural thing that they have evolved with. And so there could be something with that, and I'll look into that so I can find out what it's about.
Thank you, Chair Clem. I'm trying to understand what we're talking about today. In terms of listing, my understanding based on what you've said to me is that Oregon is not interested in listing the sage grouse, but is waiting to find out what the feds are going to do in terms of listing this bird. Is that a correct reading and what you've told us?
Chair Clem, Representative Van Orman, that's correct. Oregon is taking no steps to list sage grouse under the state endangered species list.
Okay. Follow up.
Please.
And I would like to say, as a person who is allergic to juniper, anything we can do to eradicate juniper is okay with me.
Representative Wingard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Anglin, who's filing these requests with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Department to list the sage grouse?
Chair Clem, Representative Wingard, I can't remember which organizations they were off the top of my head, and I don't have that with me. There's been several different environmental organizations that have expressed concern. I don't have that with me, sir.
Mr. Chairman, may I?
We'll just any follow-up or is that for the moment?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Shoffler.
Well, I'll try and answer the representative's question. It's the very same people that want carbon-free energy. It just doesn't add up for me. I'm very frustrated, and I've voiced that in the past, but I bet you dollars to donuts those same organizations want the construction, generation, and transmission of carbon-free energy. And you just can't have it both ways.
Okay. Representative, anybody?
He's taking the wind out of our sails.
Yeah. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Kurt, are you going to stay up for this next one and bring up? Okay, great. So, actually, did we have any members of the public to comment on that part? No, thank you.
Any sage advice?
Okay, I'm going to open our public hearing on House Bill 2224. Do you want to tell us about the bill, or do you just want to have the department public record? Committee
House
staff is going to tell us about the bill briefly.
2224 broadens the authority of the State Department of Fish and Wildlife to require fingerprinting for purpose of criminal records checks, and we have two impact statements on that, a minimal expenditure impact and a no revenue impact. Thank you.
Education is worth going back then.
So, we're handing out our little letter here from the agency, but why don't one of you two get us started?
Thank you, Chair Clem. Members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And with me today, I have Roxy Burns, our Human Resource Administrator. Want to briefly go over our testimony here on House Bill 2224, which would expand the department's authority to conduct criminal background checks on vendors, volunteers, ODFW employees, and particularly in areas of employees in areas that have access to sensitive information, information like Social Security numbers, dates of birth, important business records, and tax information. And this bill would essentially bring the department's authorities into concurrence with the authorities of many other state agencies that already have these abilities. A little bit of background. Since 1990, we've been conducting criminal background checks on our employees who are authorized to use firearms as part of their job description. We did that under Executive Order 90-05. Beginning in September of 2004, we began conducting criminal background checks on our, on our employees that have access through the information and technology section to access to secure and confidential information. And then in July of 2005, with the passage of House Bill 2157, we began conducting background checks on our employees and volunteers that interact with children through our hunter and angler education programs, and as well as those that teach firearms handling to juveniles. In support of these previous measures, the department's adopted administrative rules regarding these background checks, as well as agency policy, and identified a contested case process for job applicants who are denied employment based solely on the criminal background check. And lastly, if this legislation were passed, we would be updating those administrative rules and agency policies as well. Thank you. Roxy, anything I need to add that I've left off there? All right.
Okay. Any questions for this group? Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Clem. In terms of background checks, it's my understanding that if the person's in Oregon, you have access to that information without fingerprinting, and that if you were going to do fingerprinting, it would be for anybody who's lived outside of the state for a certain period of time. Is that correct?
Chair Clem, Representative Van Orman.
And I think we need to have you identify yourself for the first
time.
I'm
Roxy Burns, the Human Resources Administrator for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. For criminal history checks, there is what we do when we initially hire someone or for volunteers. We'll do a nationwide criminal history background check for the first time, and then annually we'll do the LEDS check, which is Oregon only.
Okay.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question, Kurt. You mentioned you got this authority via executive order for some other parts of the department. Why not executive order here?
Chair Clem, Representative Gilliam, that's a good question. I don't have the answer to that. I believe the executive order in 1990 was specific to employees that had access to firearms or used firearms in the course of their business. So, Roxy, is there something I'm... Can you answer the representative question?
I think I can.
Okay.
Chair Clem, Representative Gilliam. In when the legislation was passed in 2005, what happened was that the FBI would not conduct checks, nationwide checks, unless there was statutory authority. So that was why there was a big push in 2005 to get many states under the criminal background check. So we have to have that to get that nationwide background check data.
And I'm guessing, I mean, I think the question was why, if it was statutory authority that was required, I'm guessing maybe we were in between sessions at one point and the governor's office was able to provide the equivalent of statutory authority. Because I think his question is why executive order, not why did we pass the bill in 2005, but why did we use executive branch authority to do this and why not continue to do that? Generally speaking, legislators hate that, myself included.
Yeah, I do too.
I hate operating under executive authority when it's appropriate at the next convenient time to have the legislature consider it.
Amen.
It's legitimate to do it when that's the confines, but as we've heard on our, remember the pet detectives, Representative Schaffler, there's an ongoing issue about executive authority versus statutory authority on, or whatever they call themselves, I forget the name of it exactly, animal something or others. Humane Society's people, anyway, who go out and do it, and that's an ongoing debate about executive authority versus statutory oversight.
But to clarify, the FBI changed their policy, which is why we need to do this. Does that make sense?
Chair Clem, Representative Gilliam, that is correct.
So, Representative Roble.
So it's interesting. The federal executive branch helped the legislative branch here recognize an area where the executive branch was using too much power here. Now we have the opportunity, so... It's nice to have these dueling executive branches.
That's right. Representative Krieger.
We have people that work in the hatch box program with the department. You've got those little hatcheries in different places. And then you have sport clubs that do volunteer-type things on free fishing day and those types of things with the department. Are all those people going to have to be checked then?
Chair Clem, Representative Krieger, we're focusing on our angler education instructors. They're already going through the background check. We have our volunteers we're targeting here are the volunteers that live on station. So much like the state parks has authority to do background checks on their volunteers that live on station, we're not expecting to go out and do background checks on everyone who volunteers to work with the department. We have, as you know, many, many thousands of folks who do that, those kinds of volunteer activities.
Thank you.
So one member of the public to testify after that. If Kurt, I know you need to leave. Will you be around, Roxy, in case we have questions after this next piece of testimony?
Yes.
Great.
Thank you.
So I've got on my list Andrea Meyer from the ACLU, who's always here to talk about natural resource stuff. I mean, it's just every day it's another civil liberties issue.
And I defend her right to pack her gun, Representative.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, I'm Andrea Meyer. I'm the legislative director for the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon. And I think in the first time in my 10 years I've ever testified before this committee on the House and Senate side. For those who have not yet met me, I am here to talk a little bit about the criminal history fingerprint background check. It was mentioned that there was a bill in 2005. This is the enrolled double-sided page of that bill, 2157, which Representative Cameron had the good fortune to shepherd through the legislative process, in which ACLU played a role in ensuring that there are some protections. I simply want to point out a few things about this bill. I have a few questions. I wanted to identify for the committee, if you are looking at the bill on line 6, it refers to the, for the purposes of requesting the state or nationwide criminal records check under ORS 181-534. That's the statutory scheme in place that sets out the guidelines that an agency has to adopt rules, have some due process remedies for folks, access to their own fingerprints, prohibiting the fingerprints from being retained by the agency, by the Oregon State Police, who conducts it, ensuring that the FBI returns or destroys the fingerprints, because these are fingerprints of people who've never been convicted of any crime, and many are sensitive to the idea of creating a database of people who have no criminal history. Some raise concerns now that, of course, the fingerprints are digital. Are they ever really destroyed or returned? And that is a question that remains, and we certainly hope both that the FBI actually does truly destroy these. I had two questions or concerns about the specific expansion, and the agency is correct. I mean, the 2157 had a bunch of agencies join in, and the we encourage them to really tailor it to their specific needs. But line 21 says they're adding, and this is new language. I've not seen this in others, and I could have missed someplace. So, in which the person resides on property managed by the department. I simply don't know the scope of that, first of all. Second of all, I don't know if children live with parents who are volunteers or others who are volunteers. I would hope it would be only people over 18. I know Representative Krieger, we had this discussion in Judiciary, since these fingerprint bills, I think, go to every single committee in the building. There is one that foster care folks, and they are limiting it to over 18 in the home. So I would certainly hope the committee would inquire just what the scope and how many people would be covered under this section, and can it be limited by age? Secondly, lines 31 includes the dates of birth. Now, this language is in 2157, something that I probably should have raised a number of years ago. If my recollection, which is never always the best I want it, last session when DCBS came in for a tweak to their bill, we talked about that a little bit. Social Security number, absolutely. But I'm worried that date of birth may be circulated a little bit differently. People may talk about their date of birth. Their date of birth may be on a calendar for birthday celebrations. That alone, I worry, shouldn't be a basis for a criminal history background check. And that is, with the ORs in that language, it does allow for that. Again, they just pulled this language from the bill from a number of years ago, so I don't think there's anything going on here. But I'd like to, as we continue to move forward over the years with this expansion, see if we can be a little bit better about narrowing it and tailoring it appropriately to the right language. So those are the two issues that I have. I'm happy to answer any questions, and I hope the committee can refine this just a little bit, and we'll...
Senator Shoffler.
Thank you, and Andrea. I really appreciate you pointing this out, and I share your concerns about the gathering and storing of people's fingerprints, especially if they're innocent of anything, any crime. I certainly don't agree that there's some pushes that people that own guns should have to register their fingerprints with the federal government and where they store their guns. And it's absurd what people are going to, and I join you in your efforts to avoid that kind of storage of my personal information. They can have mine, I don't care. But on your first question about a person who resides, if you go up to Section 2, it says person who is or will be working or providing services. That, I think, would, even if you are a minor, let's say you're 17 years old and you get a job, I think it's fair to ask for some kind of, but I think that wouldn't that eliminate children that are just happen to be living on the property?
Chair Clem.
Excuse me, Section 1.
No, Representative Shoffler, I am following your track. And that may address that.
Subsection 2 of Section 1, I think that goes down into what answering your question, I think.
I think it could and it should, and I hope it would.
Okay, fair enough.
And I think you're right. It does suggest on the front end a limitation, and that may resolve it, and it may not hurt also to just ensure over 18. I just have to say this to your comment that you don't mind if they have your fingerprints or information.
They already have them.
Well, that's true. Folks who say that, I always just remind, it's when the government makes a mistake that you have to worry. It's not whether you've done something wrong. It's when they mistakenly think you have. So I always caution folks who say I have nothing to hide. That may be true, but we're all human, and there's errors.
Thank you.
Representative Roblin.
Yeah, well, in light of what was just said, I think from my perspective on the record, if this isn't changed, what I'm voting in, it says Section 1, Subsection 2, is or will be working or providing services in a position, and then under that is sub E, in which the person resides on property managed by the department. So to me, the intent here is that they are already working, providing service in a position that is regulated by Fish and Wildlife. And if they also happen to be living on the property, that gives them the input to do it. So, and I think that's what the purpose is, so, which is what you were saying. And I just want to make sure that's on the record that from as a committee member, that's what I'm looking at.
Thank you. Further questions or conversation around the other issue then, birth dates? Representative Roblin?
In this one, when I look at it for the record, again, it says in which the person has access to Social Security numbers, dates of birth, and then it's the or. My comma always means an and, so I'm saying it has the Social Security and a birth date, but I know it probably means or because the or is there. So
sure,
I'm just saying
so.
From the perspective of a person reading it, I would like that little comma to be and birth dates or criminal records. Then it would work pretty well for me because one or the other, and I think there are times where you need the birth date to check the information on who the person is. I mean, birth dates are very important. We have a lot of people with the same names and similar birth, similar Social Security numbers, and so that they keep from making an error, I think it is nice to have that there.
Chair Clem, Representative Roblin, I wouldn't mind that, although I would certainly not want the agency to be in a situation where they know the person has access to the Social Security number, and they don't know whether they have access to the to the dates of birth. See, I'm testifying, hopefully, very just. So I agree with you, and one would think they'd have both at the same time, but so that's one solution, and the other is simply to delete date of birth, because if they simply have access to date of birth, that may not be an issue. But once you tie in, you could have criminal history information, background information, and date of birth. Anyway,
yeah.
Either way, I just think it's still
and follow up.
Yeah, Representative Roblin.
And my issue here is, I think the same is that if they have, if they're in one of these departments and have this information, it does allow them to have the opportunity to do our invasion of other people's privacy by stealing information which could lead them to take their identity and other kinds of things. And so I think we have to be very careful that if we put people in those positions to have that kind of information, that with the right people are doing it and they are not misusing their authority, to use that information appropriately. And so checking on to make sure if they didn't have a previous conviction of that kind of stuff would be good. So I understand the concern, and I'm probably okay with whichever way we want to do that, because I think birth dates are, I mean, they've almost become public information and everything. So it's not as big an issue.
Thank you.
Okay. Agency have any interest in coming back up to talk about that portion of it, the birthday issue? Okay, great. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you very much, Quinn. It's a pleasure, and maybe I'll have the opportunity further the session, but not.
Chair Clem and members of the committee, my name is Roxy Burns again.
8 o'clock.
When we drafted this legislation, our concern was to have consistency with other agencies. This language is primarily based off of DCBS's language. So if you chose to take out date of birth, I don't think we would have a concern with that, because there is another section of the bill that talks about confidential information, and so we that would probably be covered under confidential information as well. So we were just trying to be consistent with other agencies' language.
Okay. Any questions for the agency? Great. So I'm going to then close the public hearing on House Bill 2224. And we're going to stand in recess for a moment. Okay, we're going to reconvene or come out of recess. Just trying to figure out what the story is here. Okay, so I'm going to open a work session. The discussion on House Bill 2224, so we're in discussion. I think my feeling, as well as some others, that we probably need to ask the relevant committee to look at the sort of omnibus issue of dates of birth across all of these, so we don't just create one carve out here, and then we got to do all that work anyway in the other statutes for all the other committees.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Winger.
As I read the bill on line 6, the word may is used, and while I understand there's some concern about background checking everybody who puts the birthdays on the calendar, I think that the department would probably choose not to waste its time, although having the authority to background check anyone who might come into contact with that kind of information seems to be the kind of thing that I would leave to the department's discretion. I'm comfortable moving the bill as is.
Mr. Chair, are you entertaining a motion?
I would.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2224 to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Second.
We'll
follow your script.
Take it from he was going off script.
As usual.
We need a
with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Representative Shoffler moves House Bill 2224 be adopted with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee.
Yes, sir.
Ooh, any discussion? Representative Robel.
This one has very little financial impact, and I guess what I would say is that I hope that as we, if it's going to this other committee, that we put it on the list. It doesn't cost that much. It does have an impact.
Thank you. Let me just verify.
Minimal.
So I don't have any problem with that, but I mean,
Mr. Chair,
that's an excellent point. Representative Shoffler.
Is it possible procedurally for that to be rescinded, the referral, between now and when it goes to the floor, or do we have to, that have, action have to take place before we pass it out of committee? Do you know the answer to that? I don't.
I'm not sure.
We've done another motion. Pull it off.
After it had passed.
No, it's part of the motion. We rescind.
But we need to get a note from them. So
yeah.
The
speaker needs to rescind the.
Yeah.
Do it with the recommendation that the subsequent referral be rescinded. At least that's what I remember. We've done another committee.
I don't know the answer to that one.
Why don't we stand in recess for a moment?
You can call check it out. Yeah.
go back into work session or come out of reconvene out of recess.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Reverend Shelton. I withdraw my prior motion and would like to substitute it with a motion to move House Bill 2224 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and subsequent, and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Joint Ways and Means be rescinded.
Representative Shoffler moves House Bill 2224 to the floor with a due pass recommendation after withdrawing his previous motion, and the subsequent referral be rescinded. Any discussion?
Can you say it five times fast?
I don't think so. And as I indicated before in the work session, I think the issues at issue in particular on date of birth that Andrea drawn up, I'll make sure that that's referred off to others to have a omnibus conversation on that topic. Otherwise, I'm also pleased to support the bill. Seeing no other discussion, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Byer.
Aye.
Representative Winkins.
Aye.
Vice Chair Van Orden.
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Shoffler.
Aye.
Representative Keeling.
Aye.
Representative Robles.
Aye.
Chair Clem.
Aye. Bill passes. There's some other phrase you're supposed to say, aren't you? But,
after having met
the Constitution majority.
You can say so moved.
Most passes the bill is set to the floor.
That's right. There you go.
Okay.
Gavel. All right. Thank you.
Gosh, we got something done.
Do you have a carrier for that bill?
Oh. Representative Gilliam.
Oh, no.
I see you over there with your hand up. Was that your hand up? Representative Gilliam, would you be willing to carry this to the floor?
Mr. Chair, it'd be my honor.
Oh, thank you.
Sure. Some floor questions here.
Floor questions.
All right. Time to move on now that the our one bill is done for the day. And I'd like to call up Nancy Molina from the Oregon Independent Multidisciplinary Science Team.
This one?
Yeah. Probably been wondering what is going on with this committee.
It's not based in science.
Oh, I'm sure Representative Shoffler feels everything he says has a complete scientific basis with annotated footnotes every, you know, in his desk.
I didn't say that. Representative Krieger just said that.
Oh, I know.
Oh, okay.
It's a perfect bill. Take it. You serve some other time.
Yeah. Well, I think that's why you're supposed to allow half an hour for even the most simple of bill. Always allowed at least half an hour if there's nothing planned to go wrong with it. Still give it a half an hour, probably.
Still change.
Yeah.
As Representative Shoffler,
is or ever has been a member of the Democratic Party.
Although he kind of caught those for one reason. He didn't have to.
He's on the ball.
Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, I am Nancy Molina, and I'm co-chair of the Oregon Independent Multidisciplinary Science Team, which is IMST for short. I guess we had a little confusion about the fact that I brought a PowerPoint and we don't have the computer, but I did, as Plan B, bring a copy of the slides. So, and also there's a handout which contains additional information that you might find interesting and useful. And Chair Clem, I want to thank you for saying earlier that you have heard of us.
Yeah.
This is like a huge thing. So, great. the purpose of my being here today, pardon my voice, is just to give you a little briefing on who we are and what we do and what we're working on, and possibly put on your radar that there are there are opportunities for us to have kind of an ongoing dialogue on some of the issues that come before you.
But before you get started, I have one interesting little tidbit. So when I right after I got elected, before session started, I thought, you know, if I'm going to be in, I knew I was going to be on natural resources, and I thought, you know, I know I'm going to need some people that I could go to and ask questions about, and it would be good, I'm not kidding, if they were interdisciplinary. So I tried assembling my own first in my office with a professor from Willamette, and I said, can you find me some other people who work in this stuff so I can ask questions? And it just failed miserably. We couldn't get it together. It just didn't work. So we had a meeting with the one and the other people who didn't show up, and so it was not interdisciplinary at that time, and it flopped, and it didn't work. Then I saw your name in a Ways and Means hearing. I said, ooh, maybe I can ask questions of them. And so then I think I asked how I could ask questions of them and of you, and they told me, but I'm hoping we can all find out today how we can ask questions of you, because I think the theory is fantastic. We just need to know the reality.
Yeah.
Representative Roblin.
And apart, if you were watching the OPEC process, and ocean reserves and those kind of things, this group had a fairly significant place to play, or different parts, in recommendations and just looking at things and coming up with a design of stuff. But it was this group that met a number of times, once at OMB and other places, to talk about, from a scientific perspective, how does this stuff happen. So they've been invaluable, all of our salmon enhancement stuff. I mean, those of us on the coast that have been working in a whole bunch of natural resource areas, we did know this group existed and that they were out there thinking about all these very difficult issues from a perspective that was scientifically based.
And independent.
And independent.
And multidisciplinary.
I appreciate that a lot. So.
Which is all great. Okay, let's hear about you.
Thank you. Thank you for your comments. So looking at the first slide, I wanted to just start with a little description of who we are. For those of you that may not have heard of us, we are a statutory committee. We were set up through the legislation that created the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds. And at that time, it was thought to be a good idea to have some kind of independent committee that would be charged with providing unbiased and impartial scientific information as the agencies move forward in implementing the Oregon Plan. Our mission has kind of morphed a little bit since that time. We really cover sort of natural resources issues in general, maybe just a little bit broader than the Oregon Plan. And we do that through developing reports on scientific topics that are of interest to the natural resources folks. We also do scientific peer reviews of various plans and assessments and other kinds of analyses that they produce. We host workshops on topics of scientific relevance to key questions that are on the table. And we also hold public meetings either monthly or every other month where we discuss the work that we have in progress, and we also bring in speakers to brief us on various things that are going on in the state that are relevant to our work. We are a 7-member, as I said earlier, multidisciplinary team. The statute requires us to have a variety of disciplines, including hydrology, forestry, fisheries, agriculture, ecology. So we were definitely set up to cover the range of scientific disciplines that would be needed to deal with most natural resources issues. We are jointly appointed by the governor and the legislature. Looking at the second slide, our name is intentional. We are independent, which means we aren't under the umbrella of any particular state agency or state entity. We do have a special relationship with OWEB. They pass our funding to us. They help us through the budget process and sort of help us administratively. The other piece of independent means that we are expected to come up with our own priorities and frame our own program of work. So we don't have a director or someone that that oversees that. I want to come back to that point because it sort of begs the question, well, how do you decide what you work on? And this committee could potentially play a role in that. So I'm going to describe that in a little more detail in just a minute. As I mentioned, the multidisciplinary piece of our name means that we have a variety of expertise. The science part of our name means that we focus on science issues and we don't weigh in on policy, and that's been kind of a discussion throughout the history of IMST. At times, people have asked us to make recommendations on things like listing of salmonids for under the Endangered Species Act. We refrain from taking a position on policy issues because that's not what we were set up for. That's what you all are set up for. And finally, we're a team in the sense that while we operate by consensus, because our goal is to provide sort of the full spectrum of scientific information on any given topic, where there are minority opinions in the team about the interpretation of a piece of evidence, we include that in our reports. So that's just a little bit about how we're set up. The next slide lists the current members of IMST, and you can kind of get a sense there of the suite of disciplines that are covered. The vacant position, the recruitment for that was for someone with forestry and hydrology expertise, because that's not what we currently have. And hold on one second.
Can I say?
I just found out this morning that that position has been filled by Alan Yeagley, excuse me, who is on the faculty at Portland State University, and we haven't met him yet. We're looking forward to having him on the team. The next slide talks about our staff. We have three staff people currently. Our staff are really, really key for us to get any kind of work done. The members of IMST are part-timers. We are currently, because of the level of funding that we have, we're currently funded to work about 0.15 FTE, which is about 3 days a month. So as team members, we have a very limited ability to do a lot of the legwork to get our work done. A lot of the writing and organizing of information is done through our staff, who are currently full-time people. These are master's and PhD level faculty research assistants in the College of Forestry at Oregon State University. So they give us a very high quality level of support. Next slide talks about a little bit about our work plan development. Excuse me. We have there's a lot of places within the state system that we can go to discern what are the key topics that we should be working on and the kinds of products that will be useful to the state. And I've listed some of them there. I do attend the core team meetings, the Oregon Plan core team meetings, where the natural resources focused agencies come together and talk about how they're implementing the Oregon Plan and other kinds of topics. And that's a really rich source of information about the kinds of science questions that agencies struggle with. We also have a really close information with SUNAP from the Governor's Natural Resources Office and various other agency staff members. In the past, we have also had fairly close relationships with some of the legislative committees, particularly 2 biennia ago when Representative Bob Jensen chaired the House Water Committee. And that was a really good model for us of how legislative committees can come together and inform us of what their sense of priorities is, what are some of the key science questions that the legislature is grappling with, and how we can help. So there definitely is a role that this committee can play in terms of requesting information from us or helping us have a sense of what is important and what we should be working on. We annually review our work plans, so it's kind of a... there are lots of opportunities for us to take on new projects. We have quite a bit of flexibility, being as independent as we are, to go in new directions when that seems appropriate. Since everybody's talking about money these days, I included a slide on that lays out our funding. It's a little complicated. Basically, and I don't know, on the copy that you have, it's probably really, really small, so I don't know if you can even read it, but I'll walk you through a few key points. Basically, the bars of this graph represent the different funding levels that we've received over the biennia since we were established. Most of our funding has come from Measure 66 lottery funds. The little numbers at the top of each bar represent, the first number is the number of team members that were in place during that particular biennium, and it's varied a little bit because people rotate off the team and there's a lag in getting members reappointed. And then the second number is the number, is the FTE of staff that we have. And so one of the things that I wanted you to notice about this is that our funding has fluctuated fairly significantly over the biennia, and the way we respond to that is by adjusting the FTE of both team members and the amount of staff that we have. The line that runs across kind of the bottom of this chart represents the average FTE per team member. Originally, the vision was that each team member would contribute about 0.25 FTE, so these would be like quarter-time positions. Currently, we're at about, as I said earlier, 0.15 FTE because of the amount of funding that we have. And as I said earlier, it's about 3 days per week, and it definitely constrains the kind of work and the amount of work that we can get done. But given the funding that we have, that's kind of where we are. The last bar, the far right bar on the chart, represents the governor's recommended budget level for IMST, which is basically, in terms of lottery funds, the same as it was in 2007-2009. There is a little bit higher because there's a little bump for inflation. What we don't have going into the next biennium is some additional funding that we got in this biennium from OWEB to complete our review of the Salmonid recovery plans that they're in that the ODF&W is in the process of producing. And so what that means is that going into the coming biennium, we're probably at about 82% of what we've been in this biennium. And we're responding to that by continuing to keep team member FTE low. We think 0.15, 3 days per month, is about the minimum that we can do and have any kind of an effective program of work. And we're cutting our staff roughly in half. So we're eliminating one position, and our two remaining positions are going to about 80% time. That's kind of where we stand with regard to funding. Briefly, the next slide is just intended to show that as our funding goes, so our delivery of products goes. When we have more money, we produce more. When we have less money, we do a little bit less. The next slide, I'm sure you can't read because I can't even read in the bigger version of it. Just wanted to mention that we have instituted a voluntary performance evaluation system that's modeled on the one that the state agencies use that follows the principles laid out by the Oregon Progress Board and the Department of Administrative Services. And we just completed our first year under this system, and basically what we do is we set up our performance measures, and then we poll the agencies, the Oregon core team agencies, and ask them to give us a report on how we did, and then we assemble all that and have a discussion about what we need to be doing differently or what's working well and so on. Turning now to a little bit about the content of our work, the next slide lists, I think it does, let's see, I got out of sequence here. Yeah, your next slide talks about major reports that we've completed, and I don't know, can you read what the slide says?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I just want to give you a flavor for the range of topics that the team has dealt with. A lot of stuff related to salmonids and water quality and monitoring, that's kind of been the core of our work, but we have touched on a broad spectrum of other topics as well. The next slide talks about some of the kinds of reviews that have been requested of us. Primarily, the review work that we have done focuses on various plans that the state has undertaken for fish conservation. So there have been lots of those, and those will be continuing. But we've also done some reviews related to water quality and other issues. And then finally, there's a list of the workshops that we have carried out. And again, those focus largely on fisheries issues and monitoring. The next set of slides talks about current work that we have that is currently underway that we have on our plate right now. Probably the biggest task that we have facing us in the coming biennium is the continued review of the salmonid recovery plans that are being produced by ODF&W. The department is required under the Native Fish Conservation Policy to ask us to review those recovery plans, and so that's a pretty ironclad piece of our portfolio. As I mentioned earlier, we did receive extra funding through OEB in this biennium to complete that work. Without that funding, in the coming biennium, we'll be having to look real carefully at our other work in order to review the remaining four plans that are coming down the pike. The next slide talks about another one of our projects, which actually should be brought to completion within the next week or two, and this is a major report that talks about sort of the statistical and scientific issues that arise in attempting to combine data from a number of different sources. It isn't quite as arcane as it sounds. There's a lot of data. The state and other entities within Oregon have invested huge amounts of money to collect a lot of really good information that can be brought to bear on natural resources questions. The problem is when you try to bring all that data together, there's a lot of statistical issues that arise, and it's a lot more complicated than you might think. And so our paper is an attempt to provide the agencies, and especially the Oregon Plan Monitoring Team, with some guidance as to how they can capitalize on the wealth of information that exists in the state. And as I mentioned, we're actually having our final vote on the completed draft of this report later this week, so it should be out soon. A couple of other reports that are currently underway. One is on the impacts of urban and rural residential land use. We hope to complete that this calendar year, 2009. And it basically talks about implementation of the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds within the context of urbanization, of urban development, and some of the science issues that arise within that. And then the final current project that's underway is kind of an evaluation of the status and trends in Central and Eastern Oregon resources as they bear on the health of watersheds and on the status of salmonids. This report actually was started several years ago. We've gone through different gyrations of what it should really look like, and we're currently going through another iteration. And again, this could potentially be an opportunity for this committee to help us decide what should be in that report. For example, when we started this report, climate change was not so much of an issue. And invasive species really wasn't even so much of an issue. Well, in eastern Oregon, those are two big topics right now. So we really need to take another look at this report and decide how we're going to frame it within the context of some of these emerging issues. The next slide talks about new topics that we have identified to work on in the coming biennium. And as I mentioned earlier, depending on how much the review of the remaining salmonid recovery plans sucks up the funding that we have, it isn't clear to what extent we'll be able to initiate new reports. What we may end up doing with these emerging topics is sort of weaving them into the work that's already underway and try to treat them in that manner. But in looking at this, the list is basically climate change, estuaries, invasive species, and integrated monitoring. And I'm certain that some of those topics are interests that we share in common with this committee. So there again, there are potentially some opportunities for us to have some interaction with you on those topics. Final slide lists our website. All of our reports and reviews and other documents are on our website. We also include executive summaries for those that don't want to read the entire report. And that concludes my prepared remarks, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Schaffler, then we'll go to Representative Roblin.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for coming, and I was on the Water Committee in 2003 and then been in various committees since then, and I've had experience with you. And I support you guys and what you're trying to do, and I support maintaining your staff. And it's unfortunate we can't afford to do more study on a lot of different things. There's just a few comments I just want to make to you. The language we use or you use or we in these kinds of things and in your reports really makes a big difference. First of all, I don't think any human being can be impartial. We are narrowly confined to our body of knowledge as human beings, which makes us partial, and our history and our own opinions. And the last person to get to edit these reports gets to get their way. And also, whoever come in and ask and request for these reports frequently, whether it's you or Idaho National Laboratory or whomever, gets to have somewhat of a say on what goes in, therefore what comes out. And I think a good example, ma'am, and by the way, I'm not against you. I support you and your efforts, and I wish we had more money to help you do more study. A good example is your fourth bullet on restoring or rehabilitating ecological structures and processes to function within historical ranges in key areas for salmonids. Is a logical approach and is likely to increase high-quality habitat. If I just use that sentence right there as a criteria for how we manage our waters and rivers here in this state, you could make a logical argument that we should tear out every single dam in the Bonneville Power Administration. And that would not be logical. You see where I'm going with it? I just wanted to give you an example of how I think language, you need to be careful with it, because, and there are those that are making that argument, and I think they are illogical, clearly, because unless they want to quit using electricity. So that's the only, I, once again, I support you in your efforts. I want to get more money to study these things because it is beneficial when we make, we just had the sage-grouse thing here today. I don't want us to get in a situation, I don't want my daughter's legislature being faced with issues of, oh, well, the unintended consequences that we didn't know about then, and now we got to tear down these transmission lines. You follow me on where I'm going here? So, once again, though, I appreciate you coming, and I like what you're doing, for the most part.
Chair Clem, Representative Schaffler, it's interesting to me that you brought up that bullet, because as I was preparing the handout, I looked at that bullet again and realized that it doesn't entirely reflect the thinking of the team, that the handout was prepared 2 years ago, and The reason that I didn't change it is because I can't unilaterally change that. It requires a vote of the team, and I will be bringing that particular bullet up for discussion with the team when we meet on Thursday and Friday this week. So your input is really timely, and I appreciate it.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Chair Clem. First to his point, and then my other question. I think that what gets confused so often with respect to scientific data is a scientific statement has no, it doesn't care about the political outcomes or the other unintended. That's not their purpose. And so from my perspective, I read these statements as a scientist. That's how I was originally trained to be an oceanographer. And I say, yeah, that makes scientific sense. If you want a system to work as it worked before, it would be good to get it back to the way it was before. Now, that doesn't take into consideration that we have people here and we have other expectations and other things. So from a scientific perspective, this makes sense. It wasn't trying to be a policy statement. It was being a scientific statement. And I think so often we try to make scientific statements into policy statements, and they are totally different creatures. Mm-hmm. And I would hope that my science community would, in the preface and in the explanation, say, given, this world that the scientist is looking at that's narrow, here's what we can do. Now, to mitigate that, to do other kinds of things, we need electricity, therefore XYZ happens, or given that the dam is there, here's the best way to proceed scientifically. And the other part, I guess, that I really want to emphasize is that, and this is a big conversation I've had on a research institute issue that I have for coastal research, because what hopefully we as legislators need to have is information, and it's good information that's replicable. I mean, for me, the scientific model is the perfect one, because if you understand where the information came from, how it was obtained, and all of that, you can decide if you want to replicate that argument, or if you want to set up another set of circumstances which would give you a different answer based on the data that was collected. And I think we forget that in this body. Everybody's looking for the answer that will support their belief, as opposed to, let's just keep the scientific information out there. And I guess the thing I was saying, were you involved in the first invasive species conference we had last year that a whole bunch of departments came up with?
No.
It was very, very good. And I would hope that you would look at some of the information that came out of there. Most of the agencies were there. There was just information. They brought in some people who have eradicated a couple invasives in California, aquatic species that they eradicated, which is just shocking that it was able to be done. And it's intensive. But there were actually, it was actually a very, very good conference. I hope that as time goes on, we can continue to have those kinds of discussions in this state, because it showed how expensive it is if you want to try to get rid of something that's already here, how much cheaper it would be to keep it out, all of those kinds of options. So, and so mine is mostly, I think having your independent group is really important, and I know, because of having read some of them, that there are very, very robust conversations that don't come to final agreement with everybody, mm-hmm. and that's what we should. That's what science is about. And the people who don't agree with the majority get their say, and I think that's important and helpful to all of us in making good decisions. Is to have both of those sides. So I want to thank you for what you're doing, and the concept is really good. I think there are places in our state where we probably should have more of this with different groups, to help us. And the last one, do you do modeling when you do stuff? Because I don't think we do a very, very good job in this state or any place I've seen where we actually develop a model and then get for us to be able to see what that model is going to tell us about the future. And I know there's a lot of controversy about modeling, but to me it's when we make these policies, if we haven't done some of that, I think it's almost... And it's mm-hmm. disappointing. So, modeling.
Chair Clem, Representative Roblin, working 3 days a month does not allow us much
true.
Time to do any modeling. We're not so much a developer of information, or in the sense of doing research, or a builder of tools, so much as we gather together existing information and try to synthesize it in a way that fits the context of Oregon and the context of the issues. So unfortunately, the answer is no, we don't. We would love to have to be a big institute that had the luxury of building the ultimate models that would give you all the answers that you need, but the paper on data aggregation that we're just completing has a whole section on the use of models in providing a forum for bringing together disparate pieces of information. That's about all that we've done on modeling per se.
Representative Krieger, do you have something?
Yep.
Yeah, and then I'll come again.
Yeah, I have several questions, Mr. Chair, and maybe some statements.
Go for it.
Dealt with the multidisciplinary independent team back in 99. Well, actually, it was after that because we were working on the Northwest Forest Plan class of the Tillamook State Forest. A couple questions. How are you compensated? What is the compensation for the members of the team?
Chair Clem, Representative Krieger, it's a little bit of a complicated story, so I'll try to be brief. Team members who are federal employees receive no compensation from the state, so the federal agency donates their time. Team members who are state employees, so i.e. faculty members of a university, their salary is offset, so they receive their same level of compensation out of IMST funds given how much time they spend working on IMST. And then people like me who are private consultants operate under contract with the state. Hmm. So there's three different ways of that compensation happens.
Okay. You mentioned it's here that you operate by consensus. And up above it says impartial scientific advice, and as you've heard, having no bias, no agenda or an opinion come into something. And Mr. Chair, I would ask that staff get a copy of Science 101, Dr. Paul Adams. It was given to us on the Board of Forestry by our former Jim Brown because it, and I think I gave you a copy.
Yeah, I got one.
Because it really describes the difficulty that a scientist has, even if they're trying to take opinion, bias, and agenda out of their work. And so when you look at this thing and it tells you what to question and what to look at, and I use it for this committee, for judiciary, everywhere, because the same type of process I think is important.
Paul Adams.
Dr. Paul Adams is where we got it from. There are a couple of papers I'll talk to staff about maybe getting the Forest Practices Act that they've completed a report and also the hatcheries in 98-2001. I'd like to see the committee have that because a lot of what we do is around water, salmon, endangered species, and that type of thing. The issue on the next to the last page about required under native fish conservation, current projects, recovery plans, they had to do the required under the native fish conservation plan. I believe there's supposed to be 36 plans. They haven't implemented them. Thus, I'm pushing them to implement the plans now. And I don't know how you can review something other than maybe the facts of how you do a review. Mm-hmm. As to the validity of the original idea of what a native fish conservation plan is, but to look at them for the purpose of saying what did come out of it. You can't do that because they haven't been implemented yet.
Mm-hmm.
Modeling, and you brought this up, and that was one of the real problems we had was because Dr. Sessions came to us about the productivity of the class of forests in Tillamook, and I've said it, I think, in this committee already that I was listening to this, and I'm saying, no way are they going to get to this number, just for the background that I have in forestry.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they came in here, then after I left the board, they came into the committee. Well, it wasn't quite accurate. We're not going to generate the dollars. Well, how far were you off? 50%. And I told them I'd get two lagers and a case of beer and come closer than that. You know, so It depends what you put in a model.
I agree.
Yes.
I can get a model to tell me anything I want it to say, and that's why people are becoming more and more suspicious of models, that they really don't get us to where we want to go. But I think if you can ever find a way of getting the bias and the agenda and the opinion out, and I know that's hard. They say you can't do it. That's what the paper basically says, but it tells us how to find it and kind of weed it out. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem I had is when we came, or they came and were helping us, we were really asking them pretty specific questions about what we needed to do about riparian zones, high-risk sites, salmon, you know, high quality salmon habitat, you know, the value of protecting it, trying to get some answers. One of the questions I asked, and it's on record, it's taped three times. I won't tell you who I asked it to, it was on the team. Do you have any information to show us that increasing the size of riparian zones would help or improve salmon habitat and survival of fish? Three times I was told yes. Three times I was told they would get it to me. Three times they failed to. Finally, I found out it didn't exist. That you cannot let happen. Don't ever tell a board, a commission, or a legislative group that something exists, and this is what you're basing your science on, only 5 to 6 years later be told and be able to prove that it didn't exist, because that really takes the credibility of you away. Thank you.
Chair Clem, Representative Krieger, if I could respond to your points in maybe reverse order. And I think the instance that you mentioned with riparian zone size, that I think that predates my time on the team, so I can't really respond to that. And I absolutely agree with you. That should not happen. That's inexcusable. So I apologize on behalf of whoever was on the team then. They shouldn't have done that. With regard to your comments on models, I personally could not agree with you more. And in fact, we have quite a discussion in this new paper that we're putting out as to how to avoid some of those pitfalls, and made some actual sort of suggestions or recommendations that the state consider in the further use of models. A couple things come to mind. There's sort of a sweet spot of complexity in models, very, very complex models, and models that are overly simple are the ones that you can, you know, get into trouble with the worst. The other thing that people almost never do when they employ models is run the model and then change the assumptions of the model and run them again. You know, that is just basic science, and I think because models, especially the really complex ones, are really expensive and really time and data intensive, it almost never happens. But those are some of the kinds of suggestions and the guidance that we're providing. You mentioned recovery plans. The review that we've been doing of the recovery plans doesn't relate to the success of implementation. It just relates to the quality of science and the logic of the analysis that goes into making the recovery plan. So we have a pretty narrow focus in terms of the review that we do. And then finally, with respect to the comment about impartiality and bias, and address this to Representative Schaffler as well, it would be the height of lack of truthfulness to say that we don't have opinions about the things that we review. Quite often, we among the team, we don't have the same opinions. And
sounds like the legislature.
Yeah, even more so. And the stuff that we argue about, you just wouldn't believe. But we try really hard to hold each other honest, and we take this charge of impartiality really, really seriously. And when we come to these agonizing discussions where we go through our draft reports word by word by word, and we try really hard to weed out the opinions, weed out the we think the state should. If there are alternate points of view, we try really hard to make sure that those are both described fairly. So those are some of the kinds of things that we try to do to keep the bias out.
Thank you. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for being here with us. I just have a couple of quick questions looking at the ORS. So we started the team in 97, 4-year terms. I'm just interested sort of in the span. It doesn't really say how many you can have. Right now we've got 7. Mm-hmm. And can you just briefly say how many are repeat terms or, and how long that you stretch over what mm-hmm. period of time from that?
Sure. Chair Clem, Representative Gillum. The statute provides for a 4-year term and one reappointment. So a person could conceivably be on a team for 8 years. Of the current team, there are 1, 2, 3 of us in our second set of 4 years.
And then I was just interested in, you said you were consulting. What's your background? Tell us a little bit about your...
Chair Clem, Representative Gillum. I'm an ecologist, a terrestrial ecologist by background, and I'm actually retired from the Forest Service and BLM. I worked all my career in Western Oregon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Wouldn't you like to have her opinion on the Western Oregon plan revisions? Well.
You'd have to take it back to the team and then spit out a few years later.
Give her opinion.
Representative Schaffler wishes he had a nickel for anybody, for everybody that's ever said to him, do you do modeling? But
that's so before we go to Representative Schaffler, two things for me. One, if we could get a review at some point. I've created my office with some of my daughter's toys, some paper clips, and a toothpick, a climate change model. I have a cough drop I'm going to insert later over here. I don't know if that's appropriate. Okay, no.
The finest science I've ever heard of.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you. I just, you know, it's a model. I mean, so I do have a serious point for the committee, really, not so much for our member here. I am going to be bringing a bill where we'll have some more conversation about this issue because this specifically deals with a process within agriculture where a grower or somebody who's bought a grower's land and doesn't want to be a grower believes that their soil is not scientifically valid for farming anymore. And the current process is one that, like all over the place, both sides sort of bring in their own expert and then, you know, they just duke it out. And the county commissioners try and figure out which scientist is telling the truth or not. So I've got a concept that I would like to try and sell you on. I think it's going to come to this committee, that essentially places a registry with the Department of Agriculture to sort of say these are the range of people who are certified soil analysts and are qualified to be having this discussion, and you both get to pick from that list, and that's who you hire, and not whoever else you think you can bring in. But these are the people the State Department of Agriculture believes is qualified, and there's some certifications. So just to give you some advance notice, it might get controversial, I'm not sure, but that's the point of sponsoring the bill and hearing it. So at some point, we'll have a discussion about sort of the dueling scientist theory or dueling expert theory for hire.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Troffler.
Mark Twain said, the definition of an expert is somebody from out of town. So, anyway, it would be interesting to sit down and listen to your team talk about when you're drafting these conclusionary reports. Do you keep minutes of those conversations? Yeah.
Chair Clem, Representative Schaffler, not only do we keep minutes, but our meetings are recorded. They are public meetings. And if you like watching paint dry, you might enjoy re-listening.
Thank you.
I would like to...
Representative Van Orman?
Sorry. Thank you, Chair Clem. I just would like to make a comment about bias. No matter what's written, it still is read with bias. So, you know, you just can't escape the bias, whether it's written or it's read. It's there.
Representative Robles.
And I'll go one more back to my modeling skills. Anything that scientists do can be used for good or bad. It doesn't have a good or bad side. It is what it is. And the question that's asked is as important as the answer you get. If you don't know the question that was asked and then you use the information to answer other questions, you are getting outside the science realm. So I go back to the whole idea about biases everywhere. But when it comes to modeling, I think the greatest advantage to having us do some of it is not for what it says directly will happen, but all the unintended consequences that we never even think about. When a good complex model is developed, it points those out to us. So it gives you a bigger scope of what you're doing that doesn't exist in the conversations that most of us have, where we think as cause and effect, everything is cause and effect. And models have been very clear in pointing out that cause, effect, and other effects exist when we make policy. And I think that to use any tool and assume that it's going to give you the answer is really a bad. And hopefully that's kind of what your report is saying as well. But to not use the tools that we have to take a better look at things, I think, is not doing justice to the opportunities that we have. And I mean, if you look at in business, if you look at the Senge stuff that's been happening at MIT and others, it's all about making your model, collecting the right data, knowing what kinds of things to put into the model. All those make it very complex, but we currently have computing power and others that will give us better opportunities to guess what we're really doing. Because I sat here, and many others have, where we go in one session and produce a bill. We come back the next session to fix all the things that it did that we didn't anticipate it was going to do. And you can get some of those answers. They won't tell you. Again, the art of this business that we are in, and even in the science community, is in how we ask questions and what we do with the answers that we get that hopefully help make good public policy. And I
trust
so it still is. Science is used as oftentimes as the scapegoat and also as the answer, and they never claim to be either. They claim to say, and that's why that book that Representative Krieger talked about, I mean, it's really a definition of the scientific method, which is hopefully the core of what each of these people do. So
I spent, Nancy, 30 years of my life, of my 36 around him, and still I can't seem to get much of it to rub off because I'm up there still with my weird modeling, and I'm not the knowledgeable, thoughtful person you've got at the end of the table.
Mr. Chair, I think they should throw Representative Krieger's case of beer into all these formulas and I get a better result.
Okay, I think we're about ready to adjourn. Thank you very much
for spending time with us,
and I'm going to close our informational hearing and adjourn the House Committee on Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Rural Communities.